Reacher stood up and moved to the window, found the track cord and pulled the drapes closed. No real reason, it just felt like the appropriate thing to do. "When did it show up?" he asked.
3 days after the first one came in the mail," Froelich said.
"Aimed at you," Nagley said, "rather than Armstrong himself."
"Why? To make sure you take the first one seriously?"
"We were already taking it seriously," Froelich said.
"When does Armstrong leave Camp David?" Reacher asked.
"They'll have dinner there tonight," Froelich said. "Probably shoot the breeze for a spell. They'll fly back after midnight, I guess."
"Who's your boss?"
"Guy called Stuyvesant," Froelich said. "Like the cigarette."
"You tell him about the last 5 days?"
Froelich shook her head. "I decided not to."
"Wise," Reacher said. "Exactly what do you want us to do?" Froelich was quiet for a spell.
"I don't really know. I've asked myself that for 6 days, ever since I decided to find you. I ask myself, in a situation like this, what do I really want? And you know what? I really want to talk to somebody. Specifically, I really want to talk to Joe. Because there are complexities here, aren't there? You can see that, right? And Joe would find a way through them. He was smart like that."
"You want me to be Joe?" Reacher said.
"No, I want Joe to be still alive."
Reacher nodded. "You and me both. But he ain't."
"So maybe you could be the next best thing."
Then she was quiet again.
"I'm sorry. That didn't come out very well."
"Tell me about the Neanderthals," Reacher said, "in your office."
She nodded. "That was my first thought, too."
"It's a definite possibility," he said. "Some guy gets all jealous and resentful, lays all this stuff on you, and hopes you'll crack up and look stupid."
"My first thought," she said again.
"Any likely candidates in particular?" She shrugged.
"On the surface, none of them. Below the surface, any of them. There are 6 guys on my old pay grade who got passed over when I got the promotion. Each one of them has got friends and allies and supporters in the grades below, like networks inside networks. Could be anybody."
"Gut feeling?" She shook her head.
"I can't come up with a favorite, and all their prints are on file, condition of employment for us, too. And this period between the election and the inauguration is very busy. We're stretched. Nobody's had time for a weekend in Vegas."
"Didn't have to be a weekend. Could have been in and out in a single day."
Froelich said nothing.
"What about discipline problems?" Reacher asked. "Anybody resent the way you're leading the team? You had to yell at anybody yet? Anybody underperforming?"
She shook her head. "I've changed a few things, spoken to a couple of people, but I've been tactful. And the thumbprint doesn't match anybody anyway, whether I've spoken to them or not, so I think it's a genuine threat from out there in the world."
"Me too," Nagley said. "But there's some insider involvement, right? Like, who else could wander around your building and leave something on your boss's desk?"
Froelich nodded. "I need you to come see the office," she said.
They rode the short distance in the government Suburban. Reacher sprawled in the back, and Nagley rode with Froelich in the front. The night air was damp, suspended somewhere between drizzle and evening mist. The roads were glossy with water and orange light. The tires hissed, and the windshield wipers thumped back and forth. Reacher glimpsed the White House railings and the front of the Treasury building before Froelich turned a corner and drove into a narrow alley and headed for a garage entrance straight ahead. There was a steep ramp and a guard in a glass booth and a bright wash of white light. There were low ceilings and thick concrete pillars. She parked the Suburban on the end of a row of 6 identical models. There were Lincoln Town Cars here and there, and Cadillacs of various vintages and sizes, with awkward rebuilt frames around the windows where bulletproof glass had been installed. Every vehicle was black and shiny, and the whole garage was painted glossy white, walls and ceiling and floor alike. The place looked like a monochrome photograph. There was a door with a small porthole of wired glass. Froelich led them through it and up a narrow, mahogany staircase into a small first-floor lobby. There were marble pilasters and a single elevator door.
"You two shouldn't really be here," Froelich said. "So say nothing, stick close to me and walk fast, okay?"
Then she paused a beat.
"But come look at something first."
She led them through another inconspicuous door and around a corner into a vast, dark hall that felt the size of a football field.
the building's main lobby, she said.
Her voice echoed in the marble emptiness. The light was dim. White stone looked gray in the gloom.
Here,
she said. The walls had giant raised panels carved out of marble, reeded at the edges in the classical style. The one they were standing under was engraved at the top, the United States Department of the Treasury. The inscription ran laterally for 8 or 9 feet. Underneath it was another inscription, Roll of Honor. Then, starting in the top left corner of the panel, was an engraved list of dates and names, maybe 3 or 4 dozen of them. The next to last name on the list was J. Reacher, 1997. Last was M. B. Gordon, 1997. Then there was plenty of empty space, maybe a column and a half.
That's Joe, Froelich said. Our tribute.
Reacher looked up at his brother's name. It was neatly chiseled. Each letter was maybe 2 inches high and was inlaid with gold leaf. The marble looked cold, and it was veined and flecked, like marble everywhere. Then he caught a glimpse in his mind of Joe's face, maybe 12 years old, maybe at the dinner table or the breakfast table, always a millisecond faster than anyone else to see a joke, always a millisecond slower to start a smile. Then a glimpse of him leaving home, which at that time was a service bungalow somewhere hot, his shirt wet with sweat, his kit bag on his shoulder, heading out to the flight line and a 10,000-mile journey to West Point. Then at the gravesite at their mother's funeral, which was the last time he had seen him alive. He had met Molly Beth Gordon, too, about 15 seconds before she died. She had been a bright, vivacious, blonde woman, not so very different from Froelich herself.
"No, that's not Joe," he said, "or Molly Beth. Those are just names."
Nagley glanced at him, and Froelich said nothing and led them back to the small lobby with the single elevator. They went up 3 floors to a different world. It was full of narrow corridors and low ceilings and business-like adaptations. Acoustic tile overhead, halogen light, white linoleum and gray carpet on the floors, offices divided into cubicles with shoulder-high padded fabric panels on adjustable feet. Banks of phones, fax machines, piles of paper, computers everywhere. There was a literal hum of activity built from the whine of hard drives and cooling fans, and the muted screech of modems and the soft ringing of phones. Inside the main door was a reception counter with a man in a suit sitting behind it. He had a phone cradled in his shoulder and was writing something on a message log and couldn't manage more than a puzzled glance and a distracted nod of greeting.
"Duty officer," Froelich said. "They work a 3-shift system around the clock. This desk is always manned."
"Is this the only way in?" Reacher asked.
"There are fire stairs way in back," Froelich said. "But don't get ahead of yourself. See the cameras?"
She pointed to the ceiling. There were miniature surveillance cameras everywhere there needed to be to cover every corridor.
"Take them into account," she said.
She led them deeper into the complex, turning left and right until they ended up at what must have been the back of the floor. There was a long, narrow corridor that opened out into a windowless square space. Against the side wall of the square was a secretarial station with room for one person, with a desk and file cabinets and shelves, loaded with 3-ring binders and piles of loose memos. There was a portrait of the current president on the wall and a furled stars and stripes in a corner. A coat rack next to the flag. Nothing else. Everything was tidy. Nothing was out of place. Behind the secretary's desk was the fire exit. It was a stout door with an acetate plaque showing a green man running. Above the exit was a surveillance camera. It stared forward like an unblinking glass eye. Opposite the secretarial station was a single blank door. It was closed.
"Stuyvesant's office," Froelich said.
She opened the door and led them inside, flicked a switch, and bright halogen light filled the room. It was a reasonably small office, smaller than the square anteroom outside it. There was a window with white fabric blinds closed against the night.
"Does the window open?"
Nagley asked.
"No," Froelich said. "And it faces Pennsylvania Avenue anyway. Some burglar climbs up 3 floors on a rope. Somebody's going to notice, believe me."
The office was dominated by a huge desk with a gray composite top. It was completely empty. There was a leather chair pushed exactly square against it.
"Doesn't he use a phone?" Reacher asked.
"Keeps it in the drawer," Froelich said. "He likes the desktop clear."
There were tall cabinets against the wall, faced with the same gray laminate as the desk. There were two visitor chairs made of leather. Apart from that, nothing. It was a serene space. It spoke of a tidy mind.
Okay,
Froelich said. The mail threat came on Monday in the week after the election. Then, on Wednesday evening, Stuyvesant went home about 7:30, left his desk clear. His secretary left a half hour later, popped her head in the door just before she went, like she always does. She confirms that the desk was clear. And she'd notice, right? If there was a sheet of paper on the desk, it would stand out. Reacher nodded. The desktop looked like the foredeck of a battleship made ready for inspection by an admiral. A speck of dust would have stood out.
8 o'clock Thursday morning, the secretary comes in again, Froelich said. She walks straight to her own desk and starts work. Doesn't open Stuyvesant's door at all. 8:10, Stuyvesant himself shows up. He's carrying a briefcase and wearing a raincoat. He takes off the raincoat and hangs it up on the coat rack. His secretary speaks to him and he sets his briefcase upright on her desk and confers with her about something. Then he opens his door and walks into his office. He's not carrying anything. He's left his briefcase on the secretary's desk. About 4 or 5 seconds later, he comes back out, calls his secretary in. They both confirm that at that point, the sheet of paper was there on the desk. Nagley glanced around the office, at the door, at the desk, at the distance between the door and the desk.
Is this just their testimony? She asked.
Or do the surveillance cameras record to videotape?
Both,
Froelich said.
All the cameras record to separate tapes. I've looked at this one, and everything happens exactly as they describe it, coming and going. So unless they're in it together, neither of them put the paper there.
Froelich nodded.
That's the way I see it.
So who did? Reacher asked. What else does the tape show?
The cleaning crew,
Froelich said. She led them back to her own office and took 3 video cassettes out of her desk drawer. Stepped over to a bank of shelves where a small Sony television with a built-in VCR nestled between a printer and a fax machine.
These are copies, she said. The originals are locked away. The recorders work on timers, 6 hours on each tape. 6 in the morning until noon, noon until 6, 6 until midnight, midnight until 6, and start again.
She found the remote in a drawer and switched the television on, put the first tape in the mechanism. It clicked and whirred, and a dim picture settled on the screen.
This is Wednesday evening, 6 p.m. onward.
The picture was gray and milky, and the detail definition was soft, but the clarity was completely adequate. The camera showed the whole square area from behind the secretary's head. She was at her desk, on the phone. She looked old. She had white hair. Stuyvesant's door was on the right of the picture. It was closed. There was a date and time burned into the picture at the bottom left. Froelich hit fast forward and the motion sped up. The secretary's white head moved with comical jerkiness. Her hand batted up and down as she finished calls and fielded new ones. Some person bustled into the shot and delivered a stack of internal mail and turned and bustled away. The secretary sorted the mail with the speed of a machine. She opened every envelope and piled the contents neatly and took out a stamp and ink pad and stamped every new letter at the top.
What's she doing? Reacher asked.
Date of receipt, Froelich said. This whole operation runs on accurate paperwork. Always has.
The secretary was using her left hand to curl each sheet back and her right to stamp the date. The tape's fast motion made her look frantic. In the bottom corner of the picture, the date held steady and the time unspooled just about fast enough to read. Reacher turned away from the screen and looked around Froelich's office. It was a typical government space, pretty much the civilian equivalent of the offices he had spent his time in, aggressively plain and expensively shoehorned into a fine old building. Tough gray nylon carpet, laminate furniture, IT wiring routed carefully in white plastic conduit, foot-high piles of paper everywhere, reports and memoranda tacked to the walls. There was a glass-fronted cabinet with a yard of procedure manuals inside. There was no window in the room. But she still had a plant. It was in a plastic pot on the desk, pale and dry and struggling to survive. There were no photographs, no mementos, nothing personal at all except a faint trace of her perfume in the air and the fabric of her chair.
Okay, this is where Stuyvesant goes home, she said.
Reacher looked back at the screen and saw the time counter race through 7:30 and then 7:31. Stuyvesant stepped out of his office at triple speed. He was a tall man, wide across the shoulders, slightly stooped, graying at the temples. He was carrying a slim briefcase. The video made him move with absurd energy. He raced across to the coat rack and took down a black raincoat, hurled it onto his shoulders and raced back to the secretary's desk, bent abruptly and said something and raced away again out of sight. Froelich pressed the fast forward button harder, and the speed redoubled again. The secretary jerked and swayed in her seat, the time counter blurred. As the 7 turned to an 8, the secretary jumped up, and Froelich slowed the tape back to triple speed, in time to catch her opening Stuyvesant's door for a second. She held on to the handle and leaned inside with 1 foot off the ground, and turned immediately and closed the door. Rushed around the square space and collected her purse and an umbrella and a coat, and disappeared into the gloom at the far end of the corridor. Froelich doubled the playback speed once again, and the time counter unspooled faster, but the picture remained entirely static. The stillness of a deserted office descended and held steady as time rushed by.
"When did the cleaners come in?" Reacher asked.
"Just before midnight," Froelich said.
"That late?"
"They're night workers. This is a round-the-clock operation."
"And there's nothing else visible before then?"
"Nothing at all."
"So spool ahead. We get the picture."
Froelich operated the buttons and shuttled between fast-forward with snow on the screen and regular-speed playback with a picture to check the time code. At 11:50 p.m. she let the tape run. The counter clicked ahead a second at a time. At 11:52 there was motion at the far end of the corridor. A team of 3 people emerged from the gloom. There were 2 women and a man, all of them wearing dark overalls. They looked Hispanic. They were all short and compact, dark-haired, stoic. The man was pushing a cart. It had a black garbage bag locked into a hoop at the front, and trays stacked with cloths and spray bottles on shelves at the rear. One of the women was carrying a vacuum cleaner. It rode on her back like a pack. It had a long hose with a broad nozzle. The other woman was carrying a bucket in one hand and a mop in the other. The mop had a square foam pad on the head and a complicated hinge halfway up the handle for squeezing excess water away. All 3 of them were wearing rubber gloves. The gloves looked pale on their hands, maybe clear plastic, maybe light yellow. All 3 of them looked tired, like night workers. But they looked neat and clean and professional. They had tidy haircuts, and their expressions said, "We know this ain't the world's most exciting job, but we're going to do it properly." Froelich paused the tape and froze them as they approached Stuyvesant's door.
"Who are they?" Reacher asked.
"Direct government employees," Froelich said. "Most office cleaners in this city are contract people. Minimum wage, no benefits, high turnover, nobodies. Same in any city. But we hire our own. The FBI, too. We need a high degree of reliability, obviously. We keep 2 crews at all times. They're properly interviewed, they're background checked, and they don't get in the door unless they're good people. Then we pay them real well and give them full health plans and dental and paid vacations, the whole 9 yards. They're department members, same as anybody else."
"And they respond?"
She nodded.
"They're terrific, generally."
"But you think this crew smuggled the letter in?"
"No other conclusion to come to."
Reacher pointed at the screen.
"So where is it now?"
"Could be in the garbage bag, in a stiff envelope, could be in a page protector taped underneath one of the trays or the shelves. Could be taped to the guy's back, under his overalls."
She hit play, and the cleaners continued onward into Stuyvesant's office. The door swung shut behind them. The camera stared forward blankly. The time counter ticked on. 5 minutes. 7. 8. Then the tape ran out.
"Midnight,"
Froelich said. She ejected the cassette and put the second tape in, pressed play, and the date changed to Thursday, and the timer restarted at midnight exactly. It crawled onward. 2 minutes. 4. 6.
"They certainly do a thorough job," Nagley said. "Our office cleaners would have done the whole building by now. A lick and a promise."
"Stuyvesant likes a clean working environment," Froelich said.
At 7 minutes past midnight, the door opened and the crew filed out.
"So now you figure the letter is there on the desk," Reacher said.
Froelich nodded. The video showed the cleaners starting work around the secretarial station. They missed nothing. Everything was energetically dusted and wiped and polished. Every inch of carpet was vacuumed. Garbage was emptied into the black bag. It had bellied out to twice its size. The man looked a little disheveled by his efforts. He pushed the cart backward, foot by foot, and the women retreated with him. 16 minutes past midnight, they backed away into the gloom and left the picture still and quiet, as it had been before they came.
"That's it," Froelich said. "Nothing more for the next 5 hours and 44 minutes. Then we change tapes again and find nothing at all from 6 a.m. until 8, when the secretary comes in, and then it goes down exactly as she and Stuyvesant claimed it did."
"As one might expect," said a voice from the door. "I think our word can be trusted. After all, I've been in government service for 25 years, and my secretary even longer than that, I believe.